Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today for a discussion on distressed investing, the current market backdrop, and where opportunities for distressed investing may exist. I'm joined today by Michael Weiss, our founder and the chief investment officer of Yield Street, and Mark Lazary, chairman, CEO, and co-founder of the Avenue Capital Group, a leading distressed debt and special situations investment manager with over $11 billion in assets under management. Michael, Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Peter. Hey, Mark. Nice to have you on.
Thank you.
Thanks for everyone who's jumping in and is listening here with us. Today, I'm doing this out of our Yield Street office here in New York City. It's nice to be back. So Mark Lazary here, one of my favorite people, super down to earth, kind of into Superman, as you could tell from his background. Father, grandfather, sports team owner, and investor, philanthropist, political activist. I could keep going. Always enjoy my time with Mark. So Mark, thank you very much for spending time with us today. Why don't we jump into Avenue for a minute. Tell us a little bit about your background and your role today at Avenue.
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me. As always, it's always great to see you. For those of you who are investors in Yield Street, I think Michael's one of the nicest, smartest, best people I've ever met. So fabulous person. So you guys are doing great. But to talk about Avenue, started Avenue about 25 years ago, 27 years ago. I had started off as a lawyer and I clerked for the chief bankruptcy judge, went to run money for a small investment firm. Then I went to the Bass Brothers, Bass Group out in Texas, did that for a number of years, and then started just investing my own capital. It worked out really well. We did about 70% a year for about 5 years. And then we started Avenue. And again, it was my capital, that of the Bass family. And the firm has grown. It's grown quite a bit. We really focus on special sits. The firm grew, I think in our first 5 years, we were running about $1 billion. Then we ended up getting as large as about $25 billion. About 10 years ago, I decided to give back half the money, probably a little bit more than half. And we gave that money back. Just we weren't seeing as much distress opportunities. And we've been managing about sort of $10 billion plus. I think right now it's 11 plus. And you know, part of what we try to do is we try to raise money when we see opportunities, when we think now's a good time, or where in the world can you invest? We've got offices throughout the world. And we've got about 60 investment professionals, about 180 people who work at the firm. But our goal is pretty simple. It's like to look around the world, see where you can get overpaid for taking risk and where you can be at the top of the capital structure and generate equity returns doing that. So that's a quick synopsis. I'm sure we'll go into as much detail as you like.
And Mark, how do you like to spend your time at Avenue today? And how long has Avenue been around? I think that you've done north of $90 billion in investing over the years. And what has your role evolved to today? And where are you spending your time? And what are you excited about?
Well, yeah, we've invested, as you said, it's over $90 billion, close to $100 billion since our inception. Really what I do is I oversee all the different investments by sitting on the investment committee. And then there's one fund where I'm the portfolio manager, which is our global dislocation fund, where I do that with Randall Klein. But really where I spend my time is seeing what all the different PMs, portfolio managers, are doing around the world And so I sit on those committees where I'll sign off on those investments or not. And then really also sort of try to figure out for the fund that I manage, I try to see all the different things that we're doing and try to invest in sort of different areas of the world where we think we're getting overpaid for that risk.
Awesome. So that's really where distress investing comes in, or investing in areas where there's dislocation or inefficiency of capital. In your words, what is distress investing and why is it exciting? Why is it interesting? Why should people pay attention to it? And I think that it'll give us a little bit of a view as to why you and Avenue have been as successful as you have been over the years.
First of all, distress investing is fascinating, right? I mean, there's no other place you'd rather be. So if you sort of think about it, really what we try to do is we try to buy things at a big discount. So think of it this way, just to simplify it for people. And we sort of call this a creation multiple. But imagine a company makes $100 million a year, right? And it's got $1 billion worth of debt. So theoretically, that means the company's trading at 10 times. The S&P today trades around sort of 25, 26 times. So, you know, if you sort of think about it, for the equity of all these companies, they trade at pretty big multiples. So what are we trying to do? You got the company makes $100 million. It's got $1 billion of debt. That debt is divided really simply. It's divided $500 million of bank debt, which is usually five times. Then you've got $300 million of unsecured bonds. So now you got $800 million of debt. And then you have $200 million of subordinated debt. So now you got $1 billion of debt. So what do? So we try to buy that bank debt at a discount. So we'll try to buy that bank debt at 60 cents. So if you sort of think about that, if you're paying 60 cents on 500 million, you're creating a company at $300 million. And so you just create the company. Remember, it makes 100 million. You created the company at three times. It's actually, if you sort of think about that,
that's a great way to look at it.
Yeah, who wouldn't want to own a company at a three multiple? That means that over 3 years, you're going to make 33% a year, right? You get paid out, you'll get all your money back in 3 years. So what we try to do day in and day out is, at what price are we creating this? Look, there was a deal just like to show you how ridiculous the market is. So I think it was just like within the last week, company Birkenstock, who we all know, you know, they make the sandals. It's really earthy company. It got bought by LVMH. And they just issued 500 million of bonds. So triple Cs, right? They issued those at a 5.25% interest rate. So the market today is desperate, desperate for yield. Now, we would never buy that. We'll buy it, by the way, if all of a sudden they've got a problem. And if EBITDA drops, those bonds will drop. And then we could come in and buy those bonds at 50, 60, 70 cents. And we'll be at the top of the capital structure. And we'll buy something like that. And then because we own enough of the bonds, we'll be able to control a process. So really what we try to do is effectuate change. We'll go in, we'll buy the debt at a discount. And then because of our position in the debt, you try to effectuate change. So you're coming in at these huge discounts. And the reason you are is because people don't want to get involved. Nobody, you know, when something's in trouble, nobody wants to get in the middle of it. And that's the opportunity. So that's why we do day in, day out around the world.
So I think that's a great example, but I think it's a lot more complex than that, right? I think in distress investing, and part of the reason that I always find I learn a lot from you, and that I'm excited that we took Yield Street in the direction together with Avenue, is because there's execution risk, there's expertise risk, there's local jurisdiction risk. And so it's far more complex, and we'll get into that soon, which I think really highlights like why picking the right partner and why experience is so important, and maybe why you've been able to scale to 100 billion while, you know, others can. It's less commoditized of an investment strategy. But maybe another way to get more clarity around it is to give a particular example of a company or a hypothetical example of what that situation looks like.
Sure. So let's do one that had a simple capital structure, but it was a complicated situation. So Diamond Offshore. So here you have an offshore driller, had 500 million of bank debt and had $1.5 billion of unsecured bonds. So here you had this company that was there. So 2 billion of debt, And the company used to make about $200 million. So if you sort of think about that, that was about 10 times. Company ends up filing for bankruptcy. Why? Because during COVID, you ended up having oil prices dropped, everything went down. And so the company files for bankruptcy and EBITDA had dropped quite a bit and EBITDA had dropped to around, so think about it, you had $2 billion of debt and EBITDA drops to about $100 million. We started getting involved. And so here's the other thing about the company. It's in bankruptcy and we go out and buy the bank debt. And we bought the bank debt at literally around 62 cents on the dollar. So you had, you know, it was about 480 million. So that's why I rounded up to 500. You had 500 million of bank debt. We bought that debt at 60. So created the company at 300 million. It was a great investment for us. We also bought the unsecured bonds and we started buying those bonds at 20 cents on the dollar. So if you think about it, on $1.5 billion, we ended up buying that for 20 cents on the dollar. Those bonds got as low as a nickel. And so we bought some at 20, we bought some at 15, we bought some at 10, we bought more at 5. We bought quite a bit of the bonds so that we ended up having close to, I would say, you know, about a $300 million exposure, face amount of the debt. In the last 30 days, 60 days, company comes out of bankruptcy. The bank debt gets paid par. So whatever we bought at 60, 62, we ended up getting 100 cents on the dollar. And the equity, I'm sorry, the bonds became the new equity of the company. So all the bondholders got equitized. That debt today, which is now the equity of the company, if you converted it back to debt, all those bonds, it's as if the bonds are trading somewhere around 30, 35 cents on the dollar. What we really did was create cheap equity. And the reason we're able to do that is because people, it's a little bit of what you said, Michael, people don't understand the bankruptcy process. Everybody looks at it and says, company's in bankruptcy. I don't know what's going to happen. It's going to liquidate. And we got on the creditors committee and we ended up doing a deal where we took out the banks. So that worked out well. But what we tried to do was instead of having debt on the company, we equitized those bonds. And by equitizing that, it enabled when somebody looks at the company today, and we thought oil prices would go back up with the reopening, sort of, you know, your re-entry trade. And here was a cheap way to do that. Like, yeah, you could go out and buy oil. But the other thing you could do is you could buy these bonds and you're creating it at anywhere between, you know, a 20 to 40% discount of where things would trade once it came out. And that's what's ended up happening. So, you know, today we're selling out of our position in that equity because we've done really well, especially look, the bonds we bought at 20 or 30. So you did well. The bonds you bought at 5 are at 30. You've done exceptionally well. So obviously we should have bought more at 5. But when you sort of look at that, it's you're taking advantage of non-economic sellers, right? That's what's happening. You're buying from people who feel they need to sell because they don't want to take the risk. And since we have the luxury of time, we take that risk. We don't mind holding on to something for a year or two. We don't mind knowing that we're going to buy something and it may drop a little because we're very comfortable in what we think the ultimate value is. And you're never, ever going to time a bottom. What you can do is you can get involved and keep buying as long as you're comfortable in what you think the ultimate value is. And you'll end up buying from people who just, as the price goes down, get more and more nervous. Remember, these are people who bought bonds at par. So when you're selling something that goes from par to 20, I mean, you've already lost 80 cents and then it keeps going. So you have more and more people who give up. So what we try to do is just buy from non-economic sellers, if that's helpful.
So I'm going to summarize it and you correct me where I go wrong. So in summary, you have, whether it's a company or an asset or a commodity or a strategy that's often all linked to a company, goes through some level of distress. Distress could mean that they can't service the debt, that their sales drop significantly, the underlying commodity pricing drops. And so we've seen distress manifests itself in different ways. What you have the benefit of is you have, and we should talk about parts of this in a minute, but you're looking at number one, what is the key value drivers here? And where is my conviction in those key value drivers? And so do I think that, you know, energy or the, you know, machinery, equipment, land, buildings, assets, recurring revenue, inventory, whatever it is, has some level of value? Can I buy my way into this deal, whether that's through buying, you know, debt at a cheaper price or buying bankruptcy claims or whatever the vehicle is to get in? And can I manage my risk doing that? I understand that it's super complex and illiquid and it could be fighting in courts, but I have the infrastructure and the team and the budget for the experts and I have the experience. So I have a global team that can do it. Michael, you may have the same conviction. You may love this particular asset. You're going to go buy 10 million. You have no clue what to do with it. And so there's, I think there's a component to what you guys do specifically in distress, that it's not just about understanding the value of the asset, but it's also understanding how to navigate the process and how to drive value within the process, right? I've had my experience with distress and bankruptcy, and sometimes it comes looking for you even when you don't go looking for it. And so you learn very quickly how people like yourself and like Avenue Capital understand where they can extract real value from. And so I think in summary, it's the distress opportunity set is all over. Hopefully we're going to see more of it as a result of COVID, which will give us the opportunity to participate in interesting opportunities around the globe. But the key is, who are you partnering with, and do they have the expertise and the experience, the global reach, the budget, and the capability to maximize the value? And I think in many ways, that's what gets us excited about Avenue. And so what I would say is, could we talk a little bit about when you go into a distressed deal? And obviously every opportunity is different, but from a risk perspective, how do you guys think about potential outcomes, upside, downside? And then talk a little bit about the infrastructure and the global reach and how that drives value for you in these trades, and maybe in certain ways that is different than other investors might think they can create value.
So I think you summarized it extremely well. I mean, you're absolutely correct. The key to all this, so there's sort of a number of things, and you said it. First is the credit work. So you've got to have your thesis and you got to be right on that. But let's use Diamond Offshore. In that situation, you've got to be able to understand the process and work within the bankruptcy court and know all the different levers and triggers that you've got. So one of the things that got the banks really nervous was the fact that sort of the bondholders, all they wanted to do was keep the company in bankruptcy. The longer the company was in bankruptcy, the greater, theoretically, if things turned around, they could do well. So you play on that with the banks, and a number of the banks got very nervous. So that was the reason they wanted to sell. But part of that is you're using the bankruptcy process, which, you know, for if you're in bankruptcy, it could be a 1-year process, it could be a 2-year, it could be a 3-year. And you've got to sort of understand the triggers of that. That's number one. Number two, you've got to understand your credit agreements. What are the rights that you have? What's your collateral value? Are you at the operating company? Are you at the holding company? What's the assets that you actually have? Can there be a fraudulent conveyance claim? What are the different claims that people can do? You know, one of the first things you do when you start getting involved in this and you start buying claims is everybody is suing you. You've got to be comfortable that in essence, you're right on your legal analysis. So, you know, when you talk about that, and I apologize for simplifying it, but it is a huge amount of work. And you've got to understand everything about a credit from a credit standpoint, from a legal standpoint, from a process standpoint, because most people don't want to deal with all these different issues. And that's our big edge. Our big edge is that that's what we want to do.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I used to think that distress investors must have an iron stomach, right? And just balls of steel, for lack of better terms. Pardon me, is just the right phrase to use here. But the truth is that as I've gotten more experience, I don't believe that's the case. I think the reality is that you take comfort in the expertise and the knowledge and the team that you have, that really understand the process, the law, the jurisdiction, the valuation, yes, the credit work, the monetization of the asset. Because when you're operating from a perspective of more knowledge and experience, the bankruptcy world is actually very, very structured versus just other situations where there's a falling knife or a problem getting into a deal cheaper when there's less capital. There are so many different variables. Whereas I feel in many ways in a bankruptcy and a restructuring, things are actually quite organized and there is a system as to how they get done. It's just making sure that you know, you have the right team.
You're absolutely correct about that. If you have to understand the process. So what I love is when companies file for bankruptcy and you see banks or you see creditors that just have not been involved in a lot of bankruptcies, because fear becomes the prevalent thing that's going on. And if you understand the process and you know that you're going to get sued, nobody likes getting sued. You just don't. So if you understand that you're going to get sued, that you're going to negotiate, that it's a fight, and you've got to go through that process. And the fact that we've done hundreds, if not thousands of these deals gives you a huge edge because you know what's going to happen and how things are going to go. And as long as your credit work is good, but if you understand the process, you're going to do exceptionally well.
Not to switch directions here, but this just sparked an idea. Is this maybe where the infatuation with Superman came from?
No, the infatuation with Superman came about simply because when I was a kid, to try to make extra money when I was 12 years old, I was really good at math. And I worked at the local pharmacy that had comics. You know, back then you weren't supposed to pay people. You couldn't work at 12. So the way I got paid was really by Superman comic books. I would go, I'd work, and I could have all the comics I wanted. So you end up growing up with this fascination and this desire to just, you know, you had this make-believe world where good always triumphs. So I always loved that. So that was the reason how I got involved in comics.
I didn't know that, but I have seen a lot of the Superman comic collection. And I would say that unbeknownst to you back then, you were paid pretty well.
If you look back, yeah, no. Yeah, who knew? I mean, I think I got comic books. I think the comic books I got today, they're worth a fortune. I mean, you know, you could have bought them back then for 12 cents. But today, all those comic books, especially during COVID, the collectible market has gone through the roof. Yeah, so
it's been a sore topic for me. And in the Weiss home, I think either my dad or my mom are listening, so I may get into trouble here. But I had a pretty amazing collection of baseball, basketball, and football cards. I used to send them into Beckett. I'd get them graded. I bought them at this little pharmacy on Friday afternoons in our little neighborhood. And obviously, like everyone else in COVID, you know, I'm like, hey, mom, where are my cards? You know, she threw them out. But to get back to our discussion today, I think what a lot of people are curious and interested, and I don't want to say concerned, but confused about, is so much talk of distressed investing since, you know, maybe May, June time, right? Market goes upside down. People are panicking about COVID. They're like, oh my gosh, things are going to get destroyed here. Is this the next crisis? Okay, everybody's raising money, billions and billions and billions of dollars from major players. And so two primary questions, right? Number one, what's different about Avenue than some of these others? And why do you focus in the size and in the place in the market you do, which I found to be an interesting discussion in the past? And together with that question is, well, what happened to all the distress? We're seeing a ton of money being printed by governments around the world. And how is that going to manifest itself? And so in some ways, I'm watching the Dow, the S&P, and my God, Doge, and everything else out there. And on the other side, I'm walking down the streets of New York, and there are hotels that have been closed for 15 months. And so where is distress? What's going to happen? What do you think are the opportunities? Did we miss it? Did we overshoot it? Like, tell us a little bit about how someone in your seat thinks about distressed opportunities today.
So you haven't missed anything. I think what there was in March, April, May of last year, when COVID hit and markets got hit really bad, there was a huge amount of opportunity. But the minute the Fed came in and provided liquidity, a lot of that went away because people now had liquidity. So a great example is Carnival Cruise. Here's a company that has ended up over the course of last year has just borrowed more and more money through the capital markets, even though they're losing I would say $100-200 million a month. And the thesis behind that is that, look, as things open up, everything's going to come back to normal and things will be fine. I hope that's right. But what is going on is you've got a lot of companies where that hasn't worked out. And so today you've got somewhere close to $100 billion worth of opportunities that we can come in, we can buy the debt, you can buy that debt at a discount. Was that number 9 months ago $500 billion? Yes. But because of the Fed, it's lower, but there's always opportunities. And it's actually odd. So what you have today is because of what's going on and the fact that if you're not getting capital, like people should be able to borrow at 2 or 3%. If you're not borrowing at that rate, it's because there's a problem. So for someone like us, we can come in and do specialty lending deals where we're lending around 12 to 15%. We did a deal with a major airline where, you know, people haven't been flying yet. I mean, they're starting and they've come back and probably the markets are back to, or airlines are back to about 30% of where they were. But we bought 13 planes for about $150 million, older planes. And the risk was, would the company file? And we did this about sort of, you know, 3 to 6 months ago. And we bought those planes and we turned around and released those planes to the airline. And they're paying us 15% on the lease payments. So it's a senior, it's a secured by the planes, which we own. And yet the airline is paying us 15% a year for the next 5 years. So you've always got these opportunities. And that's what's happening right now. Globally, you always have companies that have an issue. So your example of today, and we're all seeing it, like you can walk in New York, you can go wherever you live. I would tell you the vast majority of the hotels are closed. Or even if they're open, it's not what it used to be. They don't have the banquet business. They don't have the EBITDA they have, but they still have the same amount of debt. All of that will start coming due in 6 months, in a year and a half, whatever it is. And really what we want is to take advantage of that so that we've got the capital, take advantage of when people are going to be forced to sell. Because sooner or later, you run out. And you run out of capital. You know, the government has put a lot of money in, but there's a number of businesses that still have problems. If you just look at sort of sporting events, people can't go into stadiums. And if they do, it's 2,500, it's 5,000 people. It's not what it used to be. So for teams, everybody's losing money, but that also means the vendors, the food services, the parking. So you've got all these companies that have issues. And they've all been waiting and they've gotten money from the government. But for someone like us, we can come in and buy those assets at a huge discount. Like, here's what's different today. I would tell you, normally when we invested, GDP was a negative number. It was negative 1%. It was negative 2%. And everybody was wondering, when are things going to turn? Today, we're buying assets at a huge discount. And yet GDP is positive. GDP is going to be 5% or 10% this year. I don't know where it is next year. The amount of capital that's come into the system is huge. Yet you still have a lot of companies. That's why I said about $100 billion just in the U.S. that have issues. If you take a look globally, that number is far greater. And that's what we take advantage of, that you have problems out there. Now, is it the scale that we thought it was going to be? No. You know, and that's good. You actually don't want, yeah, on one end, it would have been, we would have had $500 billion or $1 trillion worth of opportunities, but a lot of people would have been hurt. The government came in, they did the right thing, but you still have a bit of opportunities out there. So what you don't want to do is have a huge fund. You want to be able to take advantage of all these. You know, if somebody's got $1 billion or $2 billion to invest, I think that's plenty of capital and you'll do exceptionally well.
Awesome. So I'm going to ask you, Mark, two or three more questions that I'm curious about that I think are really interesting. I want to make it interactive. So a bunch of questions have come in, but I want to encourage people to ask questions, put them here in the Q&A, and I'll try to filter through them and get through ones that I think have more of a broad application. But please participate and ask away. So Mark, point blank, I think you've been around for a long time. You have an amazing reputation all around. You're a legendary investor. I think for the most part, the average person has not been able to invest alongside you. It's going to be institutions, it's going to be, you know, major wirehouses and sort of other more traditional. And so I want to get into understanding a little bit more about what you've built here and what's exciting. And so you talk about global opportunities. Tell us about your team. Tell us about your reach.
Sure. I think right now we have 60 investment professionals, about 180 people. We have offices in Asia, in Europe. We have offices, obviously, here in the States. You know, I would say it's probably the largest and one of the special sits teams in the world. We've been doing this for quite some time, over 25 years. And because of that and the teams that we have, we see pretty much, I would say, the vast majority of all these different opportunities out there, whether it's in Asia, whether, I mean, we ended up buying an asset reconstruction company in India. We ended up investing in a water company in Indonesia. We ended up in sort of the UK. You'll see us be one of the biggest lenders on special sits in the UK and in Ireland. Why? Because in Ireland, you had 10 banks, and today you only have 2 banks. You've got to understand the legal system in Europe. I mean, everybody's comfortable going to Europe, but the legal system in Greece or the legal system in Italy is not something you would be overly thrilled with. You want to be in Northern Europe. So you try to invest in Northern Europe as opposed to Southern Europe. You want to visit Southern Europe, but you want to invest in Northern Europe. In Asia, where are the areas that you can invest? So being an ex-lawyer and having a lot of lawyers on our team, we try to make sure that we're only investing in jurisdictions where the rule of law is paramount. So that's going to be Singapore. It's going to be Hong Kong. It's going to be Australia. It's going to be India. And if you're going to invest in Indonesia, you want to make sure that your collateral value ends up being in jurisdictions where you can foreclose. So I think a lot of this, at least for us, is there aren't that many people who have the global reach that we do and are able to take advantage of all the different situations out there.
I think that makes a ton of sense. So global reach and domain expertise in those particular markets, in that global reach is going to be very important. How else do you differentiate yourself? Is it, you know, a particular place in the market, size of, you know, deal size, asset class or industry segment? Where have you carved your niche? Because I feel you really have, but be interesting for people to more broadly understand.
Sure. I think what one of the things we've found is, it's funny, you can be a global firm, but the vast majority of global firms are, like, if you look at a Blackstone, if you look at Oak Tree, if you're going to look at a BlackRock, are exceptionally large. So one of the things we've done is we've seen that if you keep your funds to around $500 million to $1 billion, you're going to be able to generate pretty high returns because most people are not going to compete against you. The only people you're competing are the locals or people who have much smaller funds. So the fact that we're a global firm, but we're trying to keep our funds to be around that $500 million to $1 billion so that your investments are a $25 million cost, a $50 million cost, gives you a pretty big edge throughout the world.
Bigger
and that's how you can generate, that's how you generate sort of higher returns.
Yeah, I think, I don't want to miss quotes, I won't say a name, but I think there's another manager or two that I know of actually who were seeking to raise between $8 and $10 billion. And the first thing that I thought about was like, my gosh, the deal size that you need to go after for it to make economic sense, you know, is a challenge. I think that's definitely, you know, an area that you guys have carved out a niche for yourself. It also is interesting because even though the market opportunity shrunk down to $100 billion in your view, you're targeting sub 2% at peak of that distressed opportunity, right? That you're going after if you're in the $500 million, $1 billion, even a little more. A couple of interesting questions that actually came in. One is, Mark, as a lawyer, I'd love to understand how you made the transition from practicing law to the investment business. I think that's a cool question. So, you know, feel free to jump on that if you want.
Sure. Well, I became a lawyer because that's what my mother told me. So I think it was either doing law or medicine. So I thought when I was in college, I'd be a physics professor. I loved math. I loved physics. And then when I got to law school, I thought I'd be a tax lawyer. It's just, I ended up clerking for a bankruptcy judge. And I went to work at a bankruptcy law firm. And one of the things I quickly found out was being a lawyer and understanding math was actually a huge edge. Because back then, there just weren't that many people who were able to do both or could do it at a high level. And practiced law for a good solid year. And then I got out. I would tell you it was luck. I got out just simply because I went to work at a small investment bank. And I thought, oh, it'll be fun to do. Let me try this for a year or two, and then I'll go back to law. And I just never ended up doing that. I just ended up using my legal background to understand bankruptcies. And because of my, I would say, my legal background and my math background, I was able to sort of understand things a little bit quicker. I would tell you today, I think everybody's got that skill set. I think a number of years ago, it was a big edge.
That's cool. A couple of questions came in with a similar theme, so I'm going to try and put them into one question. The question is essentially, tell us about, and in summary, tell us about a deal that went sideways and what were the key, maybe one, two, or three reasons, and how do you reposition the firm or the strategy when it goes sideways? Before you answer, I would preface, and I hope you'd agree with me, I think that, listen, we always in RC need to make clear to people thinking about investing or learning about investing that there's risk in a deal. Full stop, period, end of story. I think that what we tend to want to shine a big light on is where is the top of the society, institutions, endowments, the ultra high net worth, investors, the billionaires, the centimillionaires really thinking about investing, and what kind of calculated risk are they looking to take? I could be wrong, but I'm going to say that in some ways, for all the reasons that we discussed today, distressed investing has a much greater perceived risk than actual risk, but it still has very real risk to it, whether it's jurisdiction, whether it's law, whether it's execution risk, there's a whole bunch of other things. And so presumably you have some great war stories and scars to share, but I wanted to say that out on the front, no matter how excited I am about doing business with Mark and with Avenue, there's clearly going to be risk there. But Mark, why don't you tell us about a war story that went the wrong way?
Sure. I think you hit it on the head. Look, if you don't want to take risk, go buy a treasury because that's the safest investment. So when you sort of think about it, your safest investment today makes you 25 bips. Right? And so if you're going to make more than that, you are taking risk. What we try to do is a little bit of what you said. We try to invest in things where the perceived risk is actually very high and the actual risk is actually very low. So we try to stay at the top of the capital structure. That's sort of why I think we get overpaid for the risk. Because a lot of people sort of say, okay, bankruptcy, how long is it going to take? That's going to affect, it's going to affect your investment. When we invest, we try to end up saying, look, at the discount that we're buying it at, even if things go bad, we should be okay, right? And that's usually what happens. But there is risk. I mean, obviously there's risk. You can't make 15% plus in a zero rate environment without taking risk. So a great story is just like it's, things just people would appreciate it just simply because it's somebody who's been in the news. So a number of years ago, we invested in Trump casinos. So it used to be owned by Donald Trump, filed for bankruptcy. We got involved, we bought the bonds, and we were at the top of the capital structure. And our thesis there, I don't know if people have been to AC recently or not, the thesis was that, look, you're going to have a number of casinos that are, and there were a number of casinos that were having problems, that as more casinos and in Trump casinos, there were three casinos. There was the Trump Marina, Trump Castle, and the Taj Mahal. And our view was that out of the 14 casinos that were in AC, if you went from 14 down to 10, then you would make money because, and you know, and things would start picking back up. So, you know, it was harder for people to keep going to Vegas. All you needed was a little bit less of, it had been overbuilt. Well, we were wrong. It wasn't that it was overbuilt. It's just people don't want to go to AC. It's not, they'll go. But even with a number of casinos closing down and you still found that revenue and sort of the ability to make money in Atlantic City had just gone down quite a bit. So that was an investment where the good news is we came in at a really low price and we held on to it. And it then it came out of bankruptcy and then it refiled for bankruptcy. But we ended up doing okay because our basis was so low. We still lost money on it, but it wasn't what other people would have. You know, and we were just, the thesis there was wrong. We thought that by having a better operation and having fewer casinos, the remaining casinos would do better. And it just didn't end up working that way. So you're going to be wrong sometimes. The good news is when you're wrong and you've come in at the top of the capital structure, you've got a lot of room for mistakes. And so that's why we try to stay there. You know, it limits your upside. You can only go from, you know, if you buy debt at 60 or 70, you can only go to par. But because you're there, there's a lot of for error where hopefully you're not losing your principal, but you're losing it's a value of money. So yeah, it's like there's a lot of others. You know, I could spend the next 3 to 4 hours going through things. I try to block them out, but you remember all the things where you've lost money. And it's usually because there's been a fundamental shift that's happened, or the bankruptcy took a lot longer, or there was something that happened in the process where there was a judgment that ended up going against you. So the good news is, you know, most of the time we're right, but you are going to have situations where you are going to get hurt.
Awesome. I'm going to wrap up here in 2 minutes, but I'm going to encourage any more questions to come in. Don't be shy. Send them in. That's what makes these conversations even more fun. Mark, I think I'm going to switch to the Bucks for a second, but only because I actually think that there's a connection point between the Bucks and distress investing and the rebound. So we talk about the Bucks from time to time. And I remember talking to you when there was no games, then when there were very few people at the games. Now there's probably a few more people. What are you learning from the Bucks ownership as far as how mass gatherings are coming back? How many people are more comfortable coming to games with travel picking up? I'm sure you get to see a lot of these data points through your friends and your community of owners, not just in the US, but globally in sports ownership. Has that helped inform your view on what the rebound is going to look like and where there might be opportunities, whether it's hospitality or sports and entertainment or otherwise?
I think you're going to see a huge rebound. I think everybody wants to get back to normal. But for local and state authorities, I think you would find that more people would be there. You're being limited by the health authorities. So really what that's telling you is that there's this massive demand. I think it's the same thing on the travel side. So I think travel and leisure is going to do really well. I think restaurant industry, anything that is going to be related to travel and leisure is going to turn pretty quickly. So we're seeing that. So we're trying to take advantage of that. That's why we invested in that airline a number of months ago, because we knew that when things broke, it would break and it'd break to the upside. So I think that's what you're going to see. I think right now people just, they want to get back to normal. And as more and more people get vaccinated, you've already got a group of people who never cared. So whether that was 10%, 20 or 30, to them, they didn't care whether you're vaccinated, whether you're wearing a mask. So you've already got, I would tell you, probably a third of the population who didn't care. Then you've got two thirds do care. You know, could that be 75%? And that group of people are being vaccinated. And I think you'll find next 30, 60 days, the demand from people for things to get back to normal is going to be pretty overwhelming.
Awesome. Mark, thank you so much for your time. We went over. I got a little selfish because I just love hanging out and spending time together. I know you're going to shoot me for saying this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I hope our audience really appreciates the opportunity to get to hear from you. You kind of sit there in your office like, you know, you're just a normal guy chilling on the other side, which is part of what I love about you, but you still are Mark Lasry, managing billions of dollars, incredibly politically connected, philanthropist, and NBA team owner. And so it's quite an opportunity and honor to be able to spend time with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Have a great day and hope to see you again soon.
No, it was my pleasure. Take care and thank you for having me.
Awesome.
Take care, Michael. Take care, Peter. Bye-bye.
And for those interested in learning more about YieldSheet's offering that will focus on the distressed investing, be sure to visit www.yieldsheet.com to learn more about our offerings. This webinar includes the views and opinions of the speakers and may not reflect YieldSheet's or Avenue Capital Group's views. No liability is accepted for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss that may arise from any use of the information contained in or derived from this podcast. The contents are for informational purposes only, are based on information available when created, and are subject to change. It is not intended as investment, legal, or tax advice, and does not consider a recipient's financial objectives.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7-10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.